Today, I speak with Mike Jasper about our journey spanning over a decade of friendship and career milestones. From humble beginnings at Clear Channel Radio to becoming a top brand partnership agent at Endeavor, Mike shares the secrets of navigating the evolving world of marketing. Tune in for a conversation filled with insightful anecdotes, industry wisdom, and the art of authentic deal making. All that and more on today's episode of The Marketing Mad Men.
They say marketing is a madman's game. So now we turn it over to The Marketing Mad Men with Nick Constantino and Trip Job.
Happy Saturday. Welcome to The Marketing Mad Men. Nick Constantino here, and we've got a show. We got my boy here. We're going to have some fun conversations, and this is completely improv. He doesn't know what we're talking about. I don't know what we're talking about. We got beer, so let's hit it. First off, Mr. Jasper, please introduce yourself.
My name is Michael Jasper. I am a longtime friend of Nick's here. We've known each other almost 15 years.
I think it might be even 15 years. Let's 15 call it
years,
that. That
sounds
like a
little
nice
bit longer.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. And now he's on a no-fly list, so that's a good start.
Yep, that's right.
So Jasper, let's start with... Let's go back. So we met back in the day. We were at Clear Channel, now iHeartMedia. So we were at Clear Channel. So we started in radio together. What do you remember about that office? We were in Washington, D.C. What do you remember about that office? What comes to mind about those times back then?
I remember, first and foremost, I started there when I was
a baby.
I was a senior in high school. It was my summer internship leading into my senior year, and then I was an intern there all throughout senior year.
Yep.
And I worked in the promotions department all through college, and then when I graduated and I was looking for a job, I thought, oh, I'll just go back and work in the promotions department. Turns out that the 2009 recession prevented that from happening.
A little bit.
Stuck me on the sales floor, and that's where I met you.
Yeah.
where I met you. And it was interesting because coming out of college, you're trying to figure out what you're doing in life. You know, the world is your oyster. And all of a sudden, it's like, here's a job that's 100% commission.
Yep.
And you need to go call every blind shop and flower shop in the D.C. metro area and try to sell them a $100 on-air ad spot and hope they buy it.
It's called. It was called a draw back then. So pretty much what that means is they pay you money, but if you don't make it back in commission, they take the money away from
you. You owe it to them.
Which is an amazing thing. And luckily, the industry doesn't work that way anymore, but... one of the things I tell people is marketing has changed so much. Like, you can't be a specialist anymore.
That's correct.
And one of the best ways to have yourself thrown into the fire is working in radio.
That's right. Yeah.
The kinds of clients you see, the field, how many average, it is a free for all. And everybody, it is a world of C students, which I'm not saying it in a bad way here. I'm saying most people around you are just trying to figure it out. This is not rocket science. There's no Harvard baccalaureates behind it running it. This is just C students all trying to figure stuff out. And honestly, I don't know if I ever would have went into marketing or done what I did if I did not have that base in it. We got started, we got to know each other. Just shout out the stations real fast. So
yep. DC 101, Hot 99.5, WMZQ, Wash FM.
Wash, yeah.
And then there was one more.
It was a news station.
It was a new,
That's fine.
Yeah.
There's also
WTOP or something like that.
No, definitely not TOP. If we were there, we would all have been much wealthier. That's another part of the media industry. There's also paraphernalia happening that makes you forget everything that's going on from those days. So we'll save that conversation for more R-rated time. All right, so we're in radio. We did a lot of stuff together. We ran on a lot, saw a lot of different things.
Yeah, ad sales then was a unique place, right? Because you were either selling airtime, you were selling website space, or you were selling event sponsorship.
Yep. And we were early in the website space.
It
was still like a tack along where it had some streaming or some stuff like that.
We were selling banner ads by the pixel.
Yeah, which is insane.
Which is a crazy thing to think about.
Worth zero. But anyway. So let's fast forward a little bit. So we'll put the cart before the horse really quickly. So now Mr. Jasper is one of the most accomplished agents for Endeavor is the corporate name, WME, William Morris Endeavor, Ari Emanuel, whatever you want to call it. But to get there, he had to start in the mailroom. And I know it's cliche and people talk about it, but talk a little bit about heading out to LA. Talk about the ambition you had, why you wanted to get into it, and what you actually had to do to get into it, because I think that will make the next conversation when we talk about what the life is for an agent a lot more interesting.
Yeah. So just to set the stage and give anyone listening a little bit of background. So I currently am a 12-year, 10-year brand partnership agent at WME.
Okay.
And I work in our Nashville office and I...
Leaning on country music.
Correct. My concentration, my day-to-day concentration is to broker brand partnerships and commercial endorsements for the roster of country music artists that we represent out of Nashville.
They represent.
So I've been at WME for 12 years, and I actually started in the LA office. Okay. So I moved to Los Angeles in early 2012.
Yep.
I found my way into the mailroom at WME LA in spring of 2012, where I literally pushed a mail cart. Right. I delivered the mail. I got to start meeting the people that were there, the assistants, the agents, the support staff, and really start understanding the ecosystem of WME at the time.
Yeah. But that was not their intention. Their intention was to break you and make sure that you can do this so you even have the privilege of getting to the next level, which was like only a half of a step up to begin with. And I say that jokingly, but when there's so much demand to be in an industry, they have the ability to do that.
That's correct, right? You know, if you go back to 2012, which I think was the good old days were ending, right? Yep. There were years in the 70s, 80s, and 90s where it was, you know, flush with money, race your Porsches down Sunset at lunch, glitz and glam, and those types
but there
of
were so many less people in the industry.
That's right? Correct.
It was a contract agent.
Well, it wasn't commercialized.
There was no sponsorships.
It wasn't sexy.
Yeah.
Right.
So the people who were making all that money was because there was only eight of them making all that money. And now there's hundreds of thousands of them in these fields that are sharing money, having access to tickets. They get the perks of life.
So. Right, right. Well, but then let's talk about pop culture, though, because you had movies like Jerry Maguire. You had shows like Entourage. So all of a sudden, the kind of behind the scenes that an agent or a manager or anyone in the industry, their day-to-day role was all of a sudden exposed, not in a bad way, but sure. Exposed to the masses. So people started to understand, oh, there are people behind the scenes that are actually doing the admin and the logistics to make it all work. So I'm in the mailroom back in 2012, and I'm learning how to work phones. I'm learning who all the booking agents and the tour marketing agents sure. and the brand partnership agents are.
Sure.
And this is only within the music department, sure. right? There's still film and television. Sure. There's still books and literary. There's still,
you
know, our public.
And then you got into the sports because you guys hadn't acquired
IMG at the time.
You haven't even got into the sports.
That wouldn't happen for another 2 years.
It's its own beast in itself.
Correct.
I mean, now because of the way these NIL deals are working, you got high school kids that are on these rosters. It's just getting bigger and bigger, and the amount of money being thrown out gets bigger and bigger. But we're back in the mailroom. So,
yeah, right.
So again, like just, you know, they joke about it, right? Pushing a cart in the mailroom. It started in Wall Street is really where this started.
Correct.
The kids that push carts in Wall Street. What was that like? How long did you do it? What did you have to endure to get yourself to the next level? Because, man, I remember, I won't tell the full story of when you came to see me in Vegas. I won't go into too much detail of that one. But I will say that you were almost broken at that point. You were always a positive kid. I knew you were happy. But
yeah.
the tear and the toll it was taking on you really was manifesting itself.
Yeah, right. I think for anyone that wants to try to comprehend and understand what the mailroom is don't think of it like fraternity hazing. That's not what it is, yeah. right? There's no crazy things that are happening except for the fact that you are working incredibly long hours. But the mailroom has a purpose.
Yeah.
The purpose is not to prove that you're worthy enough. It's to break you down to the bare bones and train you on the specific yep. systems, methodologies, yep. and strategies yep. that the agency employs across the board. So yes, it sucked. Yes, the days were 14, 16 hours. Yes, the pay was $10 an hour back in 2012. Yes, I could barely afford the rent. But the point was, can WME build a foundation for those in the mailroom to help them succeed and grow throughout the company?
Yeah.
And I couldn't see that necessarily at the time, but I can look back 12, 13 years later and say, oh, there was actually a fundamental purpose there.
Yeah, and I think, and I'm not saying that I know Ari Emanuel, but I've listened to a lot about him and a lot about the way he goes about it. And I think that that's completely part of his own ethos and that he can probably do all those things still today. Now,
oh, absolutely.
One, he's a genius. He can do whatever he wants. His whole yeah. family is ridiculous, the things they've accomplished. But I think that top-down leadership is really important. My question to you is, how many people did you see around you in the same position fail?
I believe I'm the only person left in my original mailroom class still at the agency. Now, that statistic doesn't mean everyone failed.
No,
many of them succeeded and chose to move on. But to answer your question, the vast majority of the people that went into the mailroom would ultimately become assistants, but the vast majority of them would not make it past being an assistant. A small percentage, a small handful of us became coordinators, which is basically a junior agent, and then on to agent. So even to this day, I couldn't sit here and tell you one person that I started with on the same day that's still at the company.
Yeah.
And that's not That's not anything except my decision to have stayed, because that was my path.
Also,
that's my journey.
It's also a way to weed people out and make sure that everybody who's there is actually bought into it. Because
that's
by
correct.
The time you get to that place and you think back up to all the investment that's been put in you, you probably do one of two things. One is you say, screw these guys, I'm going to find something better. Or two is you go, they put me where I am, I'm going to stay here.
Right. And I'm the latter, because while it was hard to see in the beginning, the first couple of years, even as a coordinator, as an agent, there are so many incredible opportunities. I mean, I had to remind myself constantly I was getting paid in sexy, right? The access.
Sure.
The capabilities, the credentials.
Sure.
Being able to say that I worked where I worked and the allure that came with.
And luckily, you were at an age where that was still very important.
Correct.
So you're not going to go in at 40 years old with a family and give a crap about that.
Correct. I was single, no kids.
The world changed.
Right. I was in LA. I ultimately transferred to the Nashville office. There were specific things about my life that allowed that to be the right path for me.
Right.
And the
nature of what those perks are changed too, right? Where it used to be all you're doing is running around trying to chase girls, and all of a sudden you're like in the room with some of the most powerful people, and you're like, oh my goodness, it's a different piece. But you were able to do that because of the stage in life you were at.
That's correct, right? And also, as a human, the things that I was looking for in life. You know, I didn't go to LA to live in LA. I went to LA to go to grad school. Mailroom was my grad school. You can go and get a formalized education in this country in law, in medicine, and you can become a teacher.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
but there is no course that teaches you how to be an agent.
Yeah.
So Mailroom was my grad school.
Yeah.
I went to LA because I wanted to be at the mothership. I wanted to be at the hub of it all because I wanted to see the largest agency in the world and see the nucleus.
Yeah.
And that's what I got to do.
Yeah, I love it. We're going to pick back up at the break because we're going to talk about that agency and just what the world is like there. You've been listening to The Market of Madmen on Extra 106.3, and we'll be right back.
Now back to The Marketing Madmen on Extra 106.3 FM.
Welcome back to The Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3. Continue our conversation with my boy, Mike Jasper. And Jasper, you set up the scenario of working through the mailroom. And again, I want to reiterate this to everyone who thinks that's just like urban legend. It is very real, and lots of companies still do it today. Anywhere there is demand, there is a mailroom. Whether you start as an intern, whether you start in the ticketing class, whatever it is, sports teams have it. They are sitting there trying to make sure you understand the nuance of how all these departments work, because they want the best of the best. And usually if there's as much demand as it is, it's because they are the best of the best. So we're going to fast forward a little bit. So this probably starts as more you're a coordinator, but when did it start clicking for you? When did you start seeing what the industry was like and how partnerships worked and how important relationships were? How deep were you into this where it really started? And again, I think you and I had these conversations as you were going. I kind of remember that moment where it started clicking for you. And I think it was probably right around when you started making that first six-figure check. I think it timed itself kind of perfectly. But talk about when it was that moment and what clicked for you that you're like, all right, I can get this. This is something I can do and I can be great at this.
That's a really good question. And I'm going to choose to answer it in a pretty specific way, because I understood the mechanics of the industry. That was never foreign to me once I read a very specific book, right?
I understand the mechanics of how to throw a curveball. It doesn't mean I'm going to be out there pitching in the majors. Right?
Correct. But I think your question is more of when did it all start clicking? Yeah. When did it all start becoming one comprehension of a larger ecosystem? And I would say, you know, when I was an assistant and later in my tenure as an assistant, the picture started becoming really, really clear.
Okay.
And as I became a more senior assistant in the company, I was, you know, 3 years in at this point, I recognized that this is what I wanted to do. And I ultimately felt that this was something I could become good at. I knew I still had a lot to learn. But what I had to learn was not how the industry works, but I had to learn how to become an agent.
Yeah.
And becoming an agent isn't about how well can you negotiate a deal per se. It's about understanding the industry as a whole, trends in the marketplace, you know, the comparisons and comps that are happening around you. But I think more importantly, becoming an agent is about framing and positioning. How do you ultimately achieve a goal that you're trying to achieve through conversation, through email, through text? And how do you represent your clients in the best way possible to ultimately get to their goal?
Yeah.
Because I believe, and I've been working very hard for the last 12 years to try to erase this stigma, that when you hear the word agent, you just assume money, right? We're the 10 percenters because we our company is earning its money off 10% from the deal we do.
That's almost any sales role in anything.
Correct.
The thought is why does this need a sales role? And I would tell you, if you think that way, you just don't know how to deal with salespeople, because salespeople's job is to make the transaction easier.
That's correct.
Never harder. And the 10% that a salesperson does for you will save you 30% in how easy and how much easier it is to execute things.
Save you 30% headache.
At least every single time. But go on.
Yeah. And it's understanding the ins and outs and the nuances. So people think about, oh, well, an agent is there to get the most money possible. That's not wrong in the sense that, yes, we are trying to ultimately capture the most dollars possible, but it's about the structure of the deal.
Of course.
Right? So if a particular brand in this instance wants an artist to perform a certain set of services, well, they may not know that the artists don't want to, not in their best interest, don't really care. Yep. Or frankly, they may not have insight as to what's coming down the pipeline for the artist.
Not only that, they can't just get on the phone and call the artist.
That's correct.
The artist doesn't want to talk to them.
That's correct.
The artists don't just give 10% away because it's like fun for them to do it.
Correct.
They don't want to talk to the people. The line is drawn to one of the things that I, and it's so similar to what I do, especially in the sports world, but I think one of the things you're really trying to say is there's a difference between price and value.
That's correct.
And you are trying to establish a value proposition for all parties, including yourself. And now that you have skin in the game, it makes it easier to understand what the other two sides want, because when they come to an agreement, you win more, which is a positive sign of when you negotiation.
The simplest way to put it is I'm a translator.
Yeah.
Right? I translate the language that the artist speaks to the language that the brand speaks, and vice versa, because these brands are out to produce a product, provide a service.
Yeah.
Maybe they're a nonprofit or a 501c3.
They're out there to increase the bottom line. However you state what their bottom line is, that's what they're trying to do.
Correct.
They believe something is there to increase their bottom line.
And I think more importantly for this conversation, to hone in on the fact that they are brands that are not in the entertainment business. They have to make a proactive decision to engage with and work with an artist.
Sure.
Well, that industry, the artist entertainment industry, speaks its own language. So when you have a brand that manufactures a product and that's what they are experts in, and then you have an artist who's an expert in creating art, they don't talk to each other. They don't mesh.
Sure.
So they need someone to help translate. And there are so many nuances in both the brand world and in the artist world. For example, if you're a brand and you're a Fortune 500 company, you're going to have corporate policies you have to worry about.
Oh my God.
There's no corporate policy in the artist world. Are you kidding me? The artist can do what they want, when they want, because they're artists. They create. They have an artistic vision, and they're looking to express.
The only counter I would put there is the bigger you get, the more you're on tour, then all of a sudden, like, Live Nation's protocols come in place of what they do. There are more things that come as you get bigger, but while as its core, a person can speak on whoever the hell they want to.
That's correct.
And they can do whatever the hell they want to, and they don't have to worry about the brand logos and all that stuff.
An artist is an independent entity.
And they, because of the demand on them, that gives them even more freedom and flexibility.
That's correct.
Because people, and now there are very few instances where brands become so big that they can get into that lexicon of they can do whatever they want, but usually it's the brands need access to the entertainers and not vice versa.
Right, because think about the very basic psychology of advertising. Right? The most successful form of advertising is word of mouth.
Yep.
The human-on-human relationship. I've known you for 15 years.
Yep.
If you suggest a product or service to me, I'm significantly more inclined to try that product or service than if I'm driving down the road and see a billboard or a TV commercial. So brands engage talent because of the relationship that the talent have built with their fans and followers.
Of course.
They want to take advantage of that relationship.
Now, do you agree with me, though, that has gotten to be to the point where you can almost tell when people are faking? And you got to be really careful nowadays, because I think people have gotten much smarter and they're more educated. And I think the word influencer has destroyed all this, because you have all these buttholes, because I can't say the other word, out here that are just throwing their name out here. They're saying I have 1 million followers, but no influence is actually taking place. That you got to be careful. You can't fake it. You should not be talking about something that you don't actually believe in or use. And I think the brands have gotten smarter to that. And I think the artists have too. They say no more to a lot more stuff because they don't want to be associated with a product that is not something that they do, because I think it becomes clear and it doesn't work for anybody. You're kind of the liaison to make sure that works also.
Correct.
Right. You know this artist. Like, look, if that's a Cracker Barrel guy, you're not going to put him and going to put him to an Applebee's. Like, it just doesn't work that way. It won't fit, and it's never going to be a long term relationship.
Yeah, the consumers are not dumb, right? At the end of the day, and I think this was really exacerbated during COVID, when people were stuck at home and paying significantly more attention to the media that was being fed to them through their screens.
Yeah.
If you are a true fan of an artist, you can pick up pretty quickly when what they're saying, doing, or promoting is not authentic to them.
Yeah.
Now, look, there's three words that I absolutely hate, but they are the pillars of our industry: authentic, organic, and synergy. Because what good does it do for either the brand or the artist to try to force messaging down a consumer or a fan's throat that is inauthentic?
Yeah.
Look, a number, if there's a certain number of zeros on a paycheck, that shouldn't have bearing on whether or not an artist decides to put messaging in front of their fans. That artist has worked hard, sometimes decades, to build those relationships. And those are incredibly valuable, but also very fragile. Yeah. And they're a house of cards. They can be destroyed in one moment.
But there's also supply and demand. They're willing to charge what they are because people are willing to pay for it. And that's another thing that people don't understand is the economies of this. Like, the fact that somebody's willing to pay for it, that's what it's worth. Someone can offer you to pay.
Tell you to find fair market value.
$5 and a beer to do something, but that's not how the market.
Fair market value is defined by what someone is willing to pay for a good or service.
For a good or service. And when you get the artists who are in the highest demand, that's when your eyes light up too, because now you see the money on the other side and you probably have the relationships. And now look, there's a certain amount of trust, I think, that both parties have to put in each other. And that's another thing for you. Mm-hmm. That's another thing for me in my relationships. When I facilitate those relationships, I have two sides of the smoke. I could piss both of them off.
Oh yeah.
Right? That's not the way it works. The artist can piss the brand off. The brand can piss the artist off. You're in the middle. You could piss both of them off. That is risk on you. You're putting yourself on your line to be the liaison between these things also. That is worth a premium. I mean, that's ultimately how it works. So we've gotten completely off topic, as I usually do on the show. So let's talk about the day-to-day. Let's talk about how WME is structured. How many agents are there around what you're doing? Do you compete with each other? How are you figuring out what to go after? What are the conversations look like? How long does an average deal take to get up on the ground and running?
Yeah.
What's the term of it? I want to set up the kind of unsexy stuff because I think there are plenty of people that are listening. They're like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
And I don't want to scare them away, but let's be realistic because some of these things, I know your deal cycle is not, hey, let's go have a beer and we're going to sign a deal. These are incredibly complicated deals. One, the artist has to approve and they have a set of stipulations. If you've ever seen a rider for a band to play something, you know what those stipulations are. You could have a band who's played three hits in their entire life. Like, I need organic granola from this farm in Oregon, and I will not play if I don't have that granola. Like, they're nuts.
Yeah. Now,
that being said, the brand's set of protocols are almost as nuts.
That's
what
correct.
You can and can't say and where you go from it. So talk a little bit about that. I will ask you the questions. You give an answer that is framed. So what is the average time to negotiate, structure, and get a deal to paper?
Well, there almost is no average because I can knock out a social media, one-off social media post in a couple of days, but a larger tour sponsorship might take me 3 months to negotiate.
3 months, and it could be with a client that you had already known for 2 years.
That's correct.
You had 2 years to it, and that client, the last thing you pitched wasn't right, so they had to wait for the right artist to come.
Right, well, maybe this tour isn't right, or the budget didn't get approved by the CMO in time, so we have to wait for a whole other touring cycle, which is effectively a whole calendar year. So sometimes I'll miss a shot, and I have to wait another 12 months before I can take it again.
And it's one of those things where I'm sure you have gone into it, and the situation's been right, and you close the deal like that. And you're like, how the hell did that just happen?
Absolutely.
Right?
Some of the larger deals that I've done that historically would have taken me months to do can sometimes be done in just a couple of days if we set things up. Now, one, I would think exception to that is on renewals, right? Yeah. If we're going to copy and paste a deal for a year two or a year three, oftentimes those can be lickety split. But the first iteration was a multi-month process.
Yeah, and I think COVID, another thing it changed is it sped up the process of change so much that even the artists now, I mean, you're getting these guys, they have a hit, they can go from hit to being nobodies in like 6 months.
Correct.
That wasn't the case, especially in country music. My understanding is they had a pretty good farm system of who it was going to be. They go from the little club venues and they go to the theaters, the arenas, or the baseball stadiums, then they go to the tours. And they have a pretty good, and then they have the opening acts that follow through and they kind of farm system. That's kind of gotten thrown completely out of whack now. So it's even harder to predict the future. So, okay, so we got that the term changes, but let's say on average, let's talk about a really big deal is going to be, let's call it 3 to 9 months is your tenure of that happening. Then there's shorter deals. So talk about the smallest deal over the past 12 months. What's an example of what a small deal is? Not money, just like, what does it look like?
Yeah, a small deal is just a one-off social media post, right? It's one of our artists or one of the other talent that we represent, ultimately just being engaged by a brand to do one single social media post, whether that's a single frame Instagram story, a single TikTok post, you know, and those can be from a financial perspective for, you know, low five figure deals, right? And
talk about that. So what determines those price sensitivities? Is it the engagement? Is it how many followers they have? Is it how big of a name they are? What are the metrics that go into you pricing it? Because one of the things I've seen, when you look at when agencies evaluate these things, mm-hmm. they have no idea what they're talking about. They make up fake numbers and just say, this is what this is worth. And it's like, wait a second, because don't you love it where you're in, the brand wants it, but then their agency comes back and say, it's not worth that much.
Yeah, there's several different ways to do it, but I would say that the most important thing to really understand for anyone is, like, it's backed up by data. So we have... The beauty of social media is the data around it. So despite what anyone says, gross followers or collective followers actually are not the driving factor for most of the brand decision making, and not the driving factor for how we necessarily put value against sure. a post. It's sure. engagement.
Sure.
Right?
And to be fair, everyone has a different set of engagement protocols.
Correct.
Right? Is engagement, you followed it through all the way to see who purchased something? Well, you better have some pretty goddamn good advanced mechanisms to track said things so you can follow it through. Or is engagement just how many people interacted in it and spread that band, which caused the virality, which ultimately everybody wants?
Right. And it is extremely rare in 2024 for a brand to not ask for screenshots of a particular talent's social media analytics. Right? The back end.
Sure.
You know, give me the last 30 days, clicks, links, impressions, shares, views, comments, because that data, oftentimes they're plugging into their own algorithm
sure.
for what the brand determines as fair market value for that type of thing. And that's a huge challenge because I'll give a great example. A brand may come to me and say, we're going to offer this artist $5,000 for this social media post. And I'll tell them, well, they actually earn closer to $15,000 for that. And the brand may say, well, our algorithm tells us based on the data. And I have to stop them right there and say, well, hold on. You just asked this artist to go create content that could take them 30 minutes, an hour, yeah. 2 hours.
Yeah.
They could hop on stage and make 10X on that in a 2 hour period. So why should they take your $5,000 deal when they can 10X that in the same amount of period? So then I have to stop the brand and say, listen, what you're asking them, part of that value is how much reach, how much exposure, how many clicks. But the artist can't control that.
Yeah.
So the artist has to hedge the bet that the content they're making is engaging enough to produce the results that the brand wants.
Right.
So in a way, it's almost a bet. So how do I mitigate the risk of the brand under or overpaying, where the artist still feels like what they're earning is fair market compensation?
Well, I think it's also goes back to supply and demand, right? One of the reasons that artists can charge more is because they take less of these things. And
correct.
If an artist took a crappy $5,000 post, then no one's gonna pay $15,000. So where do you draw the line of what fair market value is versus what you wanna charge is? And again, the bigger the artist, because let's talk about something right now. Whether this is sports or country music, your fandom has something really big to do with this.
That's correct.
Right? Like, no matter what we say, the analytics matter, but if you're talking to the CEO of a company who really likes his stars, he's going to do whatever the hell he wants to.
I can't tell you the number of times I've had a deal either fall through or succeed because a CEO or CMO's 10-year-old daughter or 14-year-old son was a fan of that artist, and their father or mother had never heard of the person before.
I will say, if you want to take one piece of advice out of this, because ironically, what Jasper and I do is so similar. I'm just in the sports world, but ultimately, you have no idea how much influence these teams. That's why people want to be a part of teams and musicians. There is so much passion and fandom around this that is part of the influence. Like, there are people out in that stadium. We're in the Brave Stadium. We're in the Battery right now. We're walking past the stadium that have signs in that outfield that have no business with signs, but they're fans and they want to be in the outfield.
They want to be a part of it.
B2B, it should never be something. But you know what? That doesn't matter. Logic and reason go out the window. And you know what else? If you can find the person who really makes those decisions, you will be a good salesperson for the rest of your life. Don't listen to the agency. They change like water, man. Get them out of there. Just be polite, talk to them, but they mean nothing in this chain of events. If a person of power in the decision-making thing wants to make that decision, they're gonna make it. You know what they're gonna do? They're gonna high-five you and tell the agency to go F off. And the best thing in the world is when you get to watch it happen, because that's how relationships also mm-hmm. work. So if there's a piece of advice in any of this, I'm not saying if you're in the mailroom, go walk up to the CEO of a Fortune 500 company and be like, hey, how you doing? I'm Mike. Like, it doesn't work that way. But when you get to a point in your career where you do have influence over those people, all the stuff that we're talking about right now don't matter. If they believe in the artist or they believe in you, and I'm sure you've had those things where someone's like, you know what? I trust you. You know how many contracts I've signed where someone just like this, they don't even look. They talk through it. They want to get their stuff out, but then they don't even look. Usually it's covered in somehow maple syrup and bourbon when we sign, or maybe blood on the contract. but I'm saying, like, That's part of tenure. That's part of doing something for 13 years.
Because in that moment in time, it's not about the words and ink on the paper. It's about the relationship you've built and the trust that that person, that that decision maker has gained with you. At the end of the day, when you're doing your deals, you have an objective because this is business. They have an objective because this is business. But you also have a responsibility to make sure that you're protecting their interests as well as your own interests.
Because you want it to be a long-term deal.
That's correct.
That's the biggest difference.
The best word in our entire industry is renewal.
The biggest thing you can understand is that if you are trying to set up yourself to succeed, new business is the lifeblood of any organization. But if you're not renewing the business, none of it matters because you're always chasing your tail. So I think this has been great. We've gotten completely off topic again. So let's circle back. Let's talk about... let's talk about some of the mega deals. Like, yeah. Talk about the complex. We talked about Zach Bryan and Bud Light.
Yeah, correct. Or we could talk about Luke Combs and T-Mobile. We could talk about Kane Brown and Crown Royal, right? We can talk about these huge, what we'd call 360 deals that involve touch points and in their tour and with the artists themselves. And it's marketing and social media and PR and personal appearances. I mean, there's these multi-elemental 360 deals. They're becoming fewer and further between because, as you said, brands are getting smarter, but they're a blast to work on.
Yeah. And I think one of the things, this has evolved so much over the past 10 years. I remember 10 years ago when I was at Live Nation, I was running sponsorship, like because they had a deal with Starwood at the time, we could only stay at Starwood hotels.
Yeah.
And that was part of the deal. Like, cause you don't understand, you know how much a company like Live Nation is traveling? If they're only going to Starwood hotels, think about how much bottom line that is, but Live Nation has to stay somewhere. Mm-hmm. So who cares if they're staying at Starwood? They agree to get a rate. Part of that deal is like, all right, if you get Luke Combs or if you get Zach Bryan and they're drinking Bud Light, but they're out, they caught on a bar on social media drinking Coors Light, do you know how bad that is for the entire thing?
Yeah, that's a grenade.
That's a grenade, but people don't think that way. Mm-hmm. That's part of this deal. Like, you're asking this artist who's lived their whole life probably on drug-addled rages, doing whatever they want to. Now, hey, you can't have this competitive beer. That's why it's worth the money. That's where they become. But that's not how the brands think. The brands think it. They just should just be that way.
Right. I would say one of my biggest pain points of my job is when a brand strokes the check and feels like they own the artist.
Yeah.
Right. I often have to remind the brands, you're working with a human being here. Like, there's going to be slip-ups. There's going to be, especially if that artist doesn't have a lot of experience working in the brand space, right? It's a learning curve. It's training wheels.
I think the ones that have experience in it also know when to say no a lot more.
Yes.
And, like, some of these guys, they see that first check, and it might not even be the money. God knows some of these guys don't need the money, but they saw that, you know, hey, I saw this artist go, he's done this. He has all this stuff. I need to do that same
correct,
thing.
Correct, right? And we can talk about non-monetary value all day because oftentimes it's not the money that's the main driver. But for the purpose of our conversation, oftentimes if an artist and their team have their wits about them, they'll look at the deal terms and say, yeah, that is a risk. We'll breach this contract and not mean to. So they'll protect themselves by not entering into it.
Yeah, and that's one of those things. Like, contracts get really tricky because when you bring lawyers in, a lawyer's job is to keep things vague so there's more hours of
that's correct. makes it harder to breach the contracts.
But what breach is subjective. There's no objectivity in what a breach is. Like,
correct.
If you said this was XYZ and you did this post, but in the brand's head, they thought it was supposed to reach this many people, but that wasn't contracted. That's not how the world works. That's not part of the actual contract. And that's what goes into a contract. What doesn't? I mean, look, we're negotiating intellectual property. We just extended our deal with the University of Georgia. Since 10 years ago when I started to now, do you know how much harder it was to negotiate a deal with the University of Georgia? How much more complex that intellectual property goes?
I bet the contract went from 10 pages to 100 pages.
You know what the beauty of it is? It is a one piece of paper that we signed with the University of Georgia
no way.
To this day. That being said, the trust that is there is what has evolved, but what goes in now, how NIL becomes there. Then all of a sudden, we learn from the experiences. I'm thrilled that the way the contract is written is one that elicits trust between both sides, but that doesn't make us less careful. That makes us more careful because they can just say, you breached it if you want to, because the terms aren't laid out. So I just say that as you get into, again, one of the things as I went through my career, I was terrified of contracts. I didn't want to get involved in that. Now in that world, I live in that world. Yeah. I hate that I live in that world, but if you understand that world, you are a severe, serious advantage over people who don't understand that.
Yeah, I mean, some of these contracts can go 20, 30, 40 pages because you have to lay out a roadmap for what happens in any given situation. And you might have a 40-page contract that lays out, you know, 50 different situations or scenarios, and then the 51st that you didn't put in there is the one that actually happens
which
in real life.
The next contract, an extra 12 pages.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right.
And
that's
again,
right.
A lawyer's love subjectivity, right? Force majeure means an act of God. Well, what does that even mean? That's a biblical term. By the definition of mankind, God is fake. What do you mean it's force majeure? So we get into these things. We could talk.
We can nerd out on contracts for hours.
But again, it's such a part of all this. So we got one more minute lesson in this segment. Talk about your favorite deal you ever done. Big or small, it's just the one that sticks out in your head and why it was your favorite.
I did a really wonderful deal for an artist of ours named Eric Pasley back in 2016, I believe it was. And this deal has always stuck out to me. We were approached. So Eric's a type 1 diabetic.
Okay.
We were approached by a company called Dexcom, who at the time had created something called a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor. And I was able to broker a meaningful deal for Eric as an ambassador for Dexcom. And it, I would say, fundamentally changed his life, because up until the moment that deal was signed and he got the product in hand, Eric was pricking his fingers to test his insulin and blood sugar. And from that moment on, even to this day, now he wears a patch. It's an app that goes onto his phone. It means his wife, when he's on the road, his tour manager, when he's on stage, can see his glucose levels. And I just think that, you know, I'm in a business where I pair brands and artists, and a lot of times it's a temporary relationship.
Yep.
But this had a massive impact on his life. And I think that I feel very fortunate to be the gateway to help improve someone's life through a brand partnership.
Yeah, but at the same time, it worked for everybody involved, right? Great. Now all of a sudden you have an artist who used something, a function that he did that changed his life. You have a brand who probably saw a brand lift like crazy because it was actually something that was being utilized, and you had you that felt the reward of not only helping a person, but helping a brand.
That's correct.
When everybody wins in a deal, they get renewed. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Unless, you know, what if he doesn't have diabetes? I mean, there's a million reasons why it wouldn't renew, but as long as it goes
But in that
forward.
Particular situation, they did, and it was a wonderful multi-year wonderful. Relationship. I
wonderful.
Love that.
All right, we're gonna keep this conversation going in segment three. You've been listening to the Mark and Madman on Extra 106.3, and we'll be right back.
Now back to the Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3 FM.
All right, welcome back to the Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3. This has been an intense conversation. We've weaved in and out. It's gone fast, but I want to do a past and a future. Okay, we did the present. We're gonna do the past and future. So past. What advice would you give yourself besides don't take the bus from LA to Vegas to see Nick and end up playing roulette with a crown prince from Qatar or whatever weird country with somehow with vomit on your shred from the night before? Don't do that. Give advice to your younger self.
I would say to my younger self, despite the stresses, the anxieties, and the worries that I was constantly carrying throughout the mailroom and as an assistant and as a young agent, it actually will be okay. It will turn out all right. It's just so hard to see even one foot in front of you when you feel like you're drowning and you're trying to keep your head above water.
Yeah. So I will add to that by saying, any person who thinks that stress and anxiety aren't part of life is
crazy.
Fool.
They're out of their minds.
Stress is a body's reaction, and you are going to cortisol because your body is reacting to something. And anxiety is because we used to be wanderers that were hunters and gatherers that would be chased by animals trying to kill us. That's what anxiety is. It's telling your body that it's time to run, it's time to fight or flight. So it's how you handle that anxiety and that stress that differentiates the most success. Some people get off on it and the stress makes them want to do more. Mm-hmm. Some people just take a step back and be like, you know what? It's not as bad as I think I am. But I think advice to everybody is it's never as bad as you think it is. And if you look and have context, there's always somebody that has it way worse than you.
Yeah.
That being said, when you get to this point in your career, you could easily look back and say, I am worth this much, not because of right now, because of all the crap that I put in back then.
Yes.
And it is a really hard thing. But I could tell you this, bosses and the highest of people, they have an eye for that.
Yeah.
They want you to hold that grudge about those things back then, because that's what makes you pressing forward and keep wanting more, which is part of what you want in life.
Well, and I think related to that, and to me, this is something that I tell as many people as I can. One of the most dangerous things that I used to do was compare myself to other people.
Yeah.
I used to look at everyone else around me and think they're bigger, they're better, they're faster, they're stronger.
Yeah.
And it used to take a real toll on me. But what I didn't realize, because I didn't have the tools at the time, I have the tools now, right? In my late 30s, I working with my therapist for several years, I have the tools now to realize that I was so deep in my own narrative that I just assumed others thought about me what I thought about myself.
Yeah.
And that
that's
was
human nature. That's not you. That's everybody. You make a depiction of yourself of what you believe other people to think of you.
That's correct.
And there's a million things.
Well, and I was comparing myself to everyone around me because I thought they were better than me.
You know, that's so funny. I think if I was going to say one of the superpowers I have is since the day I don't give an effing crap about what someone thinks about me. And I, you know me, I've lived a lot of places. I've moved a lot. I've seen a lot of things. I've failed. I've succeeded. I've kind of winged it. And a lot of it is just because, like, I was young. I didn't feel tethered to anywhere. And seeing all those things have changed my perspective. But, you know, everybody, the most wealthy, the most happy people, usually the ones that go home to the most family problems, mm-hmm. right? The ones that are always, the ones that are showing off their $1 million cars are the ones that have the most debt.
That's right.
So you only see the tip of the iceberg in which people show you. The other thing is that when my kids were born, I made a conscious effort that social media was over. And the reason was, is that I have no shame. If pictures came out for me back in the day, yeah, my wife might divorce me, but other than that, I'll be fine. Like, but yeah. I don't want my children to be tied to these outward facing mechanism that they feel like they have to be those things.
Well, and social media is unfortunately everyone's SportsCenter top 10. Social media is everyone's highlight reel.
And they only see the best. I saw That's a correct. Girl, I'm not going to say who it was. I was at a concert and I saw a girl and she was sitting there and she would literally take a picture of herself and zoom in and like correct her teeth on Instagram before she would post. In the middle of a concert, we were watching the Smashing Pumpkins. I'm like, are you kidding me? This is what you're doing in the middle of a concert? That's what your life is? And that sucks, man.
Yeah. So I feel bad for someone like that.
We've gone off topic. So let's end with this, okay? I have been in the music industry through Live Nation, the sports industry for a long time. You have been an agent. You have been involved in all of this. What does the future of these deals look like? Where do we go from here? Because I have seen brands are going to cut back.
Yep.
You're going to see brands, they're so overstretched. The Deltas of the world, the Amexes, they are stretched in so many different places.
That's right.
Where do we go? I think AR becomes a thing, augmented reality. So mm-hmm. you have these brand experiences that really pop up. So instead of in, let's say a baseball game, you're between innings. Now all of a sudden the outfield pops up and you have these characters coming out that are become advertisements, but it's engaging. I think that will play, technology will always play a part. But where do you see some of these partnerships going in the next couple of years?
I think both as consumers and as brands, the thing that is the most effective is to create lasting memories, right? If you're a brand and you're sampling a physical product as people walk out of a venue or a sports stadium, that product is a consumable. It will be consumed. It'll be thrown in the trash. Right? Yep. But a memory will last forever. So I believe that we'll see a lot of brands start investing more in memory making virality type moments in time. You know, I think.
Would you agree? The problem is those are very hard to fake. And the thing
they're
is,
they're very hard to fake.
I hate the word organic just like you do, but there are moments that are organic that are memorable and there are things that are forced. And
yeah.
If you force them, the consumer has gotten smart enough to know that that's a fake memory.
Yeah. Look, faked or not, one of my favorite marketing campaigns ever is Lyft's Undercover Driver. I just think it was so brilliant and so smart. And it's campaigns like that to me personally as one human, but as someone who works in the industry, I believe they're really impactful. The Undercover Driver was never take Lyft. Lyft is the best. It was a content play. Yeah. It was a brand who wanted to have a little bit of fun. Do you know who's doing it the best in the world right now? Liquid Death. There is nobody better, in my opinion, that's marketing better than Liquid Death.
You want to make a bet?
Sure.
Okay. That company will either be sold off in the next 6 months or because that momentum that they've created, there's no way it continues. They're going to have to go mainstream. They're going to have to be standardized to get into the Krogers of the world and everything. They will either be sold off. All those people that all that thing, the growth will stagnate and they will become like every other brand. And here's why. When all of a sudden you realize you're going to the grocery and your groceries are now $200 instead of $100 and you realize you're paying for water in a can because of marketing, you're going to be like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. So it's not a criticism. They've done a wonderful job.
Incredible.
But I've been around a lot of CMOs and all of them say the same thing. These flash in the pan brands, but they know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You can't extend that line any further.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. Who do you think is the best brand marketing or who has the best marketing in the world, do you think?
Shoot, man. It's so hard to say. I think that Google makes some of the most impactful ads that resonate with what I do in my life, but they're also a monopoly, so they can have fun with whimsy with what they do and it doesn't matter.
I'll tell you what I think. I think Red Bull is the most disruptive marketing company in the world.
Well, Red Bull was going to be a media company before they were Red Bull. Because if you ever looked, do you know how bad Monster Energy has outsold Red Bull? Do you know their stock that Monster Energy on the S&P 500, not Netflix, not anyone, was the number one growth stock over 20 years was Monster Energy. No one even talks about Monster. They sell so much more than Red Bull. But Red Bull created, you know what the first one to do? They were a media company. Do you want to know why Topgolf succeeded that nobody saw? Everyone's like, who's going to do that? They built themselves as a media company. So when you're at Topgolf, you're watching Topgolf's channels, which have ads on them. They created media companies out of those things. It has switched over now. they have become, it's the people who can control those marketing narratives. Google doesn't win because you're searching. Google wins because they control their own supply demand curve. When someone comes in and they start advertising, every single plumbing company that comes in just drives up the price of advertising. Guess who wins? Google. Every time. So again, ironically, we're talking in circles about the same things, but all right. So future of the industry. So we're going to get more towards experiences.
Yeah, more towards experiences.
I think we're going to go intimate. I think that we've been festivaled out. People don't want to be in a concert with 90,000 people.
Money can't buy experiences. That's what we're seeing a lot more of. And I think we're also going to see brands continue to get smarter in non-monetary value. Here's what I mean. Let's say a brand wants an artist to be in their TV commercial, right? There will be a certain amount of cash associated with that. But where the value proposition is going to come in is the brand is going to say, we're going to use your new single as the music bed in this commercial, and we're going to do a $50 million national TV.
Dude, right? You're talking YouTube, Vertigo, that was on the Apple campaign when they signed the original Apple Music deal.
That's correct.
They released that album, and Vertigo did it because it was the Apple commercial.
That's correct.
Swung them back. They were out of the lexicon of people for the longest
time. It was permanently embedded in the software code of that phone.
And there is a way to do it. There are so many... commercial. You hear a commercial with the right track, that commercial becomes popular again, and some artists you haven't heard of in 50 years somehow go to top set charts. Music has changed in that sense, right?
Correct.
Like Katy Perry's album dropped, nobody cared. Nobody was downloading that album, but you had old songs that just hit it. Like the one that just came out to me was the Talking Heads. This Must Be the Place was just in a commercial, spiked the next day. People wanted, because they could plug their phone and be like, what's that song? And they listen, like, oh my God, I love the Talking Heads. So that exists more and more. But again, you're taking advantage of media that person has already bought to build the exposure of a brand.
Correct.
Those are very complicated partnerships.
Extremely complicated, because in a situation like that, you have to pay the record label, you have to pay the publishers and the songwriters. There are so many layers. I mean, that's why there's entire companies that exist to simply sync music. Anyway, your question was, where do you see the future going? I think more experiential, AR. I think money can't buy experiences. The word virality, as much as I hate that as the other three, is something that's very important because it is the truth.
Yeah.
And I think we'll see ultimately brands getting smarter. And here's what I'll say. At the end of the day, I don't know where AI is going, but AI will somehow, some way, in some form, become an important part of the celebrity endorsement and commercial ecosystem.
It already is. And the reason I say that is because Live Nation is a data company. They preemptively know the interest in the artist before they book them coming into cities, which helps them plan tours and everything. That's not someone on a spreadsheet going, man, that is AI reading data, scanning data, and making preemptive decisions. The difference is right now we've been very reactive with AI. When it starts becoming proactive, where they can book 2 years out,
we'll see a fundamental shift.
Data they have, you will see it. Now, it's not taking over the world. I use it for this show. I use so much with AI. It can't even transcribe this whole show in one sitting. Like, we're not there yet. The machines are not coming. I promise you, we're not even close to that. There are so many things. I'm like, how is this so poorly done? But we will get there. And I think that the data becomes more and more and more and more important. I hate it because when you bring data in, you're not using your instinct and the creativity. You can't force and elicit an emotional reaction with data, right? That's one of the things we've forgotten, right? You can look at it. No one ever knew that Nirvana was going to hit with Smells Like Teen Spirit, but something was different and the emotional connection was like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. They have tried to fake music now, come up with music. They plug it into your brain. They play these songs like, you should react to this. We can't fake creativity. So I think one of the things that's going to come about, we're going to go back to garage rock bands. Mm-hmm. We're going to go back to a guy and a band who just putting out killer music and a virality growing, not because it's spreading on social media, because people start talking about, this is the guy I want to go see.
Hey, it goes back to word of mouth, what we just talked about.
And I think that's one of the things is we will almost revolt against the phones and we will have a resurgence of like the old school part of music. Let's call it the mid 60s, early 70s. I won't talk about whether or not I want the drug revolution to come back. We'll keep that for another time. But it's going to be awesome. And we definitely already went over. Jasper, appreciate it, brother.
Thank you very much, Nick.
Man Action 106.3. We'll catch you next week.